You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Today,
who ordered that?
We review the year in physics with quantum physicist Ian Durham.
This would be the first evidence we have of something beyond the standard model of particle physics.
I'm Zia Morali. Welcome to a special series of podcasts from the Foundational Questions Institute. My usual co-host, Brendan Foster, isn't with me today, but I am pleased to be joined by FQXI member Ian Durham, a quantum physicist at St. Anselm College in New Hampshire. As has become an annual tradition, Ian is counting down the big physics breakthroughs of the year. In this edition, we'll hear the first part of his list. So, thank you very, very much for joining us again at FQXI, Ian Durham. I can't remember how many years we've been doing this, but we are now at the end, almost, of 2015, and it is time to review the big physics stories of the year. So, thank you.
Indeed, I'm excited. Thank you for having me again. I have no idea how long we've been doing this, but I heard a rumor that I actually have fans.
You do. It is true. It's, you know, it gets to around November and people start asking me whether we've recorded the list yet. And I think, no, we can't yet because something could happen in December that, you know, could sneak onto the list. And you know, maybe a few things have sort of happened quite recently that are sort of maybe list worthy. I guess we'll find out.
Yes, there are a few things that didn't quite make the list, but came very, very close that are worth keeping an eye on. So,
yeah, actually, we should probably tell people don't make discoveries in December because you can't officially, you know, it's tough to officially get on Ian Durham's list if you make an announcement very close up to the time of recording. It's better to aim for January.
Yeah, so I had this thought the other day about how this is a little bit like the Academy Awards. And if you release the movie too late, you don't make it for award season. But if you release it too early, the nominees forget about you. Luckily, I'm not like the Academy of Motion Pictures or whatever they're called. I keep track throughout the year.
Let's start off then with some of the things that haven't quite made the list.
Okay, so, and this is really tentative, and if it turns out to be true, I suppose it could make next year's list. The problem is when these things happen at the end of a year, but that takes a while to confirm that they really happened, which year do you award them in? So this particular one that I'm talking about is the Large Hadron Collider has found a blip in their data, a little wiggle on a graph, that suggests that there might be a new particle that no one really expected that is showing up. Now, of course, this could be just an error on somebody's part. We remember about the Gran Sasso, the neutrino experiments a few years ago where everybody thought they exceeded the speed of light and it was somebody adjusted some optical tube wrong. And, you know, there's always the danger that that could be true here too, that somebody made a mistake or there's some nut that's out of place or some bolt somewhere that somebody didn't tighten quite right. Nevertheless, there is some tantalizing evidence that the LHC may have found a new particle that's considerably heavier than anything we've seen in a while. It's 750 times heavier than the mass of the proton, if it exists. And it would be a boson, and it's heavier than the Higgs. And the question is what would it be? And this would be the first evidence we have of something beyond the standard model of particle physics. Again, we don't know. It could just be, you know, somebody misadjusted something somewhere, but nevertheless, it also could be a particle.
So one thing to say, you know, you sort of said that these are kind of, it's sort of a glimpse of a particle, but I guess one of the reasons that physicists are a little bit more excited than maybe they would be was that it's a glimpse of a particle that's been seen both by the CMS experiment and the ATLAS experiment. So maybe, yes, if, you know, just one had seen it and not the other, they probably would have just ignored it or maybe not made any kind of thing about it at all. Not that they've made a very big thing, but they might not even have mentioned it. But it's a tiny little hint, but it's interesting that they've both seen the same
right.
Hint.
Basically what it is there's a little bump on the data. And when you take the data from the CMS and the data from ATLAS and you match them up, the bump occurs in roughly the same place. And so that's why people think, oh, maybe there is actually something there. But again, it literally just happened. I believe they released the information or the data a week ago, maybe?
Yeah, mid-December.
So a week ago. So it's extraordinarily new, and we have no idea whether it'll be confirmed or not. It took them 4 years to confirm the Higgs. Nevertheless, what's really cool about it is that if it were to hold up, it would be the first experimental evidence of something beyond the standard model of particle physics, which we've known for a long time can't be the whole story of nature, because there are things the standard model predicts that we already know it predicts incorrectly. For instance, neutrinos have mass. The standard model predicts that they're massless. But there are lots of alternative extended standard models out there, but no one has ever known which to choose from, because we haven't had any experimental data to say, well, this is the right extension of the standard model, or this is the right extension of the standard model. And this would sort of help us in that regard.
Yeah, I've been sort of reading around, and as you say, it's only been out for a few days, to try and see what people are saying it might be. And they're really not saying very much, because it is so recent. And you know, I think we've heard of these things that people are looking for at the LHC before that sound very exciting. They're sort of the extra dimensions, or mini black holes, or signs of supersymmetry. This doesn't seem to be any of those. It's just something weird and new, and it's a case of let's wait and see, first of all, if it's really there, and then let's try and work out what it is and what it means.
Right, right. It reminds me of, who was it who said... years ago, it was Robbie, I.I. Robbie, quipped when they discovered the muon. Who ordered that?
Right, okay, so we're going to wait and see what happens with that. What else hasn't made it onto your list?
So there's one other thing that hasn't made it onto my list, but that, again, for the same reason that it needs some verification. And this is a really interesting story. It won't be on any other physics lists because it's more in the field of computational complexity, but that has a tremendous impact on certain aspects of physics, particularly quantum computing. And what it is, so there's an old problem that goes back a long, long way called the graph isomorphism problem. And what is the graph isomorphism problem? So if you imagine three cities, and these three cities are connected by roads, and then you imagine three other cities somewhere else that are connected by roads. Those networks, you could call them networks, they have nodes, which are the cities, and then the connections, which are the roads, or you could call them vertices and edges, right? We call them sometimes a graph or a network. And those two sets, assuming that cities A, B, and C are all connected, you know, there's a road between A and B, and a road between B and C, and a road between A and C. And the same is true for the other three sets. So you basically have a triangle. You imagine a triangle. Those two things are isomorphic to one another, meaning they're essentially, from a graph standpoint, the same thing, right? So the question is, when you get into larger and larger and larger graphs, again, thinking cities and roadways, maybe you have 100 cities, and you have 300 roads, and they're all sort of connected in a spaghetti-like shape. And then you have another set of 100 cities and 300 roads. How do you determine if those two graphs are essentially the same? In the sense of, when we say that they're the same, there's always, for every, let's say you have one city that has five roads leading away from it. Well, then you have to have a city in the other graph that has five roads leading away from it. Right?
Right.
They all have to match up perfectly exactly. So it would be like, they might not look the same, but if you were to untangle them, they would look the same. So this is a long-standing problem for really complicated graphs to determine if they are the same thing or not. And what's interesting is there's this old problem in computational complexity of determining how complicated a given problem is. And there are types that we would call polynomial time problems and then non-polynomial time problems. So a polynomial time problem would be a problem that you could solve where, you know, the larger the system gets, the more complex it gets, but the growth of the complexity, you could model it as a polynomial. So the simplest polynomial is a quadratic. Ax squared plus bx plus c, that's the quadratic. And then there's a quintic and a cubic and all that. So A non-polynomial problem would be a problem that would grow in complexity, say, maybe exponentially or something like that. The complexity gets much, much faster the larger the system gets. Well, sort of related to that then, people like to find things as close to polynomial time as possible because standard computers can essentially solve polynomial problems. Quantum computers can do some non-polynomial stuff, but standard computers have problems with the more complex things. So we like algorithms that can solve things in polynomial or quasi-polynomial time. And most people thought the graph isomorphism problem was really hard. So this guy, Laszlo Babay, and I apologize if I've completely butchered his name, back in November, he actually made this announcement that he had a new algorithm for the graph isomorphism problem that solved it in quasi-polynomial time.
So what is quasi-polynomial time? Because you explained polynomial time, you explained non-polynomial time.
It's essentially polynomial time. The coefficients of a polynomial come from this mathematical thing called a ring, which is... if my mother's listening to this, my mother would be like, what the heck is he talking about?
So I guess, right, so we're trying to decide whether this is an easy problem or a hard problem. I guess what I'm getting at is that when he says quasi-polynomial, does that mean it's easy but not quite easy? Or does it still fit in the easy camp? It seems like a bit of a sort of a weird term to use. It seems, you know, is he hedging?
I would say it's sort of a midpoint. It's a subtle difference, but it's fairly close to polynomial time.
So does this mean that he's shown that an ordinary classical computer could have a go at solving this problem?
Theoretically, yes. And the reason that I brought this up is because it has some implications for physics and probably in a lot of other areas. I mean, if you think about it, anything that is a network problem, so network problems, I gave the example of maps and roadways and things, and those really are network problems. Scientists and engineers use network theory and graph theory to model traffic flow and things on roads between cities and things like that. Actually, a very famous example of the use of this stuff is in railway modeling. So when you have a railway system, you know, you can't have two trains on the same track at the same time, otherwise they're going to crash into one another. So, you know, organizing where the trains go and when they go in different places along which connections and stuff is related to this kind of a problem. And if you have multiple different networks, you want to know, well, okay, how similar are these two networks? Because if they're really the same network, then you can just use some of the stuff from this network, from network A to model network B.
You know, this hasn't even made it onto your list, but I'm asking you a lot of questions about it because it is actually very, very interesting.
Oh, yeah, I love talking about this. This is a great problem.
And again, this is going to be, I think maybe I'm going to ask a question here that's going to make some of our listeners kind of bang their heads on the desk. But,
yeah, right.
But if he's, if he's come up with an algorithm and it's something that could potentially be done by a classical computer, will it really take a long time for people to verify that this is correct? I mean, couldn't we just take his algorithm and just, you know, implement it, and then, you know, tomorrow we'll have solved this problem?
So it's highly mathematical. People get the impression that algorithms, maybe I don't know this, but I suspect sometimes from my own teaching experience that people get the impression that algorithms mean computer code.
Yes, that would be the impression that I have.
But they don't. Algorithms are not computer code. An algorithm is simply a process. It's a step-by-step process for doing something. So anytime you have a step-by-step process for doing anything, maybe you have a step-by-step process for cleaning your house or, you know, doing your laundry, it's essentially an algorithm. An algorithm is just a set of steps. It doesn't tell you anything about how to program it. An algorithm needs to be then converted into a programming language, which can be extraordinarily difficult. He originally presented this in a series of lectures at the University of Chicago, and the actual paper just came out, and it's a lengthy paper. So people have to go through and make sure that each step actually is logically follows from the previous step, and that when you put them all together, it actually does solve the graph. First of all, you got to make sure it actually solves the graph isomorphism problem and not some maybe related problem. And then you have to make sure that in doing that, it does so in quasi-polynomial time. And that's the trick. Now, the great thing is Laszlo Babay is world famous in his field, and in fact just won an award in 2015 for his work. So he's very well known, and a lot of people trust that he's doing a good job here and that he probably got it correct.
You're making me think of an article that I wrote for Nature about scientific programming. And so these were for programs and codes that scientists are using all the time. Actually, nothing on this scale, nothing on the kind of, you know, it's 250 pages long or whatever. And it takes, you know, hundreds of people to verify. This is just things that they're using every day. And just the sort of the realization that a lot of these codes that are being used, when you actually speak to the scientists who have written them and who are using them, they have very little confidence that they're actually doing what they think they're doing in the first place. And then, you know, the idea that when they're actually being published, you know, nobody is checking them and there's no way of really independently verifying them. You can run their own code, but if their code has a mistake, you'll just get the same result they got anyway. And nobody's going to sit there and write another independent code to check you know, the claims they're making are correct. And how scientists have very different ways of checking the robustness of their code compared to, for instance, professional computer scientists who use completely different criteria for checking code block by block to make sure that, you know, as you were kind of saying, looking at every little piece to make sure that it's all adding up and it's all leading one bit to the other, whereas scientists tend to just go, well, you know, I ran it, you know, I first of all, they've just taken a code that somebody else has usually written and another 15 people have over the years modified in some way. And then they change it a bit and then they use it and then they just kind of hope for the best. And if they get a result at the end that looks plausible, then they kind of think, yeah, that's probably right. But anyway, so I wrote this whole article for Nature just kind of looking into how worrying that is. And actually, most of the people that are involved at, you know, in actually writing these programs and using them are actually very worried about the results they're getting too. So,
And it's extraordinarily difficult to, again, to verify whether these computational results are what you expect them to get and how to know when you have a computational result that that's what you should expect, because a lot of times these computational problems are applied to things that are not analytically solvable. So, for example, a very famous computational problem is the three-body problem or the n-body problem, where, you know, we have exact solutions for, say, two gravitating bodies. But as soon as you extend that to, say, three bodies or n-bodies, it gets extraordinarily complicated. And so we use methods, something like the Runge-Kutta method, to solve these n-body problems. And the Runge-Kutta method is an algorithmic method that has a little constant that shows up in it called, that we just usually call H. And it's highly, highly sensitive to your choice of H. And if you choose the wrong H, you get results that may look accurate, but aren't. And so you have to be very careful about exactly what you choose for this one little constant in your program. And the question is in these problems that are not well understood, how do we know whether we're picking these things right or not? And, you know, how do we know that the whole algorithm isn't just wrong? And it gets real tricky.
Right. Okay. So we've gone through the things that didn't get on the list.
We did.
So what did get onto the list? So we've got a top five this year.
Drum roll, please. Number five is that, again, returning to CERN and the Large Hadron Collider, they discovered this summer, finally, two pentaquarks. So what is a pentaquark? Let's first of all ask what a pentaquark is. It's simply a bound state of five quarks. And they were first predicted in the late 1970s. Maybe I should back up a second and say there are no free quarks in the current universe. There may have been free quarks at the Big Bang, but quarks are intimately bound up together. There are two quark states. Those are called mesons. Well, actually, that's a quark and an antiquark. Then you have three quark-bound states, which are your protons and neutrons. And then there's some other exotic particles floating around out there. But nobody had ever seen a pentaquark state, although they thought they had seen it in the early 2000s. In fact, several independent groups had reported pentaquarks. But most other research groups were never able to verify that stuff, and the consensus became that they hadn't really seen the pentaquark 15 years ago or whatever. Now, however, the Large Hadron Collider has found evidence for the existence of pentaquarks at a much higher mass than the early 2000s claim. The early 2000s claims were around a little over about 1,550 mega electron volts. The new claims are that they have a higher mass, closer to 4,400 mega electron volts. And they're pretty positive that these are pentaquarks now, because the gold standard in particle physics experiments is at least 5 standard deviations. Anything that's greater than 5 standard deviations in the statistical spread is considered to be a definite proof. And it's funny because the biologists all laugh at that because, you know, in biology, it's like 2 standard deviations. This is 9 standard deviations. So it's absolutely certain that these are pentaquark states. And that's pretty cool because that is, you know, something we've been looking for a long time. Was predicted, was people thought they found it and then said, well, maybe they didn't find it. Now we have definitive proof that they're there.
It's particle physics again. It's the LHC again. I'm looking at this article in Wired by Sophia Chen, and she put it quite nicely. It made me smile the way she said, the pentaquark particle, it doesn't violate the standard model of physics. So the pentaquark adds no huge plot twists, but it's a nice payoff after a lot of foreshadowing. And I guess, you know, after we sort of, you know, we discussed at the top of this, you know, that interesting bump that might be the first evidence of something beyond the standard model at the LHC. You know, this is something that, you know, it sits within the standard model, but it's just, it's exciting, I guess, anyway.
Yeah, it's exciting because it tells us that the standard model, while not complete, it's more evidence that we're on the right track. And that the standard model is a good basis to work from. I also think it's important just because, while it doesn't violate anything in the standard model, a pentaquark state is a weird state. And it's just, it's interesting from that standpoint that these things can actually exist.
In that Wired article, they've quoted Guy Wilkinson, who is the spokesperson for LHCb. So that's the experiment at CERN that found the pentaquark. And he points out there are still things that we don't know. So having said that, you know, the pentaquark fits with the standard model of physics, you know, he's kind of given this list of things that they want to know about. So, you know, one of those things is, why have they found these particular pentaquarks? So there are a number of different quarks that could come together to form a pentaquark, I guess, in theory. Why have they found the particular sets that they have? Why do they have the mass that they do? How are the quarks bound together? What other pentaquarks are out there? There should be others out there. You know, we have to go and look for them, and theorists will tell us where to look, he says. So, yep. You know, there's more to do and more to find out, I guess, more that we could learn about the standard model.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just about the standard model. In particular, this gives us a window on the strong nuclear force, because the strong nuclear force is what essentially holds nuclei together, although it's a little bit more complicated than that. So the strong nuclear force is what essentially holds quarks to other quarks, and gluons are what are the exchange or mediator particle between them. And there's a lot of interesting things about the strong force that we don't know. And one of the weird things about the strong nuclear force, that the weak nuclear force is like this too, it has a limited range. It's a very short-ranged force, unlike gravity and electromagnetism, which are theoretically infinitely ranged. The strong force drops off very rapidly, so much so that in larger nuclei, it doesn't even extend all the way to the edge of the nucleus. It's very localized, and so that's partly why you get nuclear decay, because the strong force in the smaller nuclei, the strong force overcomes the electrostatic repulsion of all those protons in the nucleus. You know, so you might ask, well, you've got all these protons in the nucleus, and they're all sort of stuck together. Well, they should be electrostatically repelling one another. How is it that they're held together? Well, they're held together by the strong nuclear force. Well, if the strong nuclear force is limited in its range, but electromagnetism isn't, then eventually you're going to get large enough that the strong nuclear force isn't going to be able to overcome the electromagnetism because it has a limited range. And that's partly why larger nuclei break down. I mean, that's a very simplified way of looking at it. But I think the pentaquark thing is important from that standpoint in that it'll help us with our understanding of the strong nuclear force. Plus, again, it's a verification. Science has two pieces to the puzzle. It's got theory and an experiment. Every time you have a theoretical prediction, you need to have that experimental verification of the theoretical prediction. Likewise, if you make an experimental discovery, it needs to be fit into some larger theory. So the two pieces have to go together, absolutely have to go together. And this is part of that experimental piece, verifying an existing theory.
So there we have it. Pentaquarks come in at number 5 on the top 5 physics picks of the year. You can read more about that discovery and the items that didn't quite make Ian's list on the website www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. Ian's list will continue in the next edition in a couple of days, so subscribe to the podcast or keep checking back in at the site so you don't miss that. While you're waiting, here's a taster of what's still to come.
I kind of liken it sometimes to a destructive fax machine. So it's like a fax machine that faxes something, but there's only one original, and as it's faxing, it destroys the original.
For now, thank you to Ian Durham. I'm Zia Morales.